portion of the meeting. We are now reconvened for the admin portion of the meeting. We have, let's see, one item on a consent, I move approval.
Second.
Oh, sorry.
I think Brian had it.
There was a delay.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, two items for discussion. First, the National Electric Safety Code Fire Danger Risk. Victor?
Yes, good morning.
Quick second. Adam, this is kind of related to something you asked us about last summer, fires and utility lines, so you might be interested in hearing this. Victor's summary of what he found. Sorry.
Good background information. Kind of start this off. Back in May 7th, the commission directed staff to check with our investor-owned and co-op utilities to see what their normal activities are to prevent fires caused by distribution or transmission power lines. So I sent off a request to all of those folks and received responses from nearly all of them. The responses are quite varied, but in my opinion, they're taking appropriate steps normally to prevent this, and almost all of the responses indicated more additional efforts this year. They were kind of wide-ranging. I wish they were more consistent so I could give you a better idea, but they varied from trying different types of fire suppression things. They were minimizing the traffic on off-trail type of inspections. But they all seemed very appropriate, in my opinion. So I didn't see a real need to force or ask for any additional information. But if you
and you provided a summary, a memo?
Yes. I had sent the memo out to you, to the three of you, I think, last week sometime.
Yeah.
It's kind of a short memo, but just kind of a quick summary with some of the highlighted points that I wanted to note.
All right. And so you don't think there's any follow-up needed with any of the facilities or companies being lacking in their approach?
I don't believe so. You know, most of it is kind of standard National Electric Safety Code types of things
Sure.
that they're doing. You know, there's rules about how often you have to inspect lines, how often you have to test poles, because really those are the big ones that cause these fires. A pole tipping over or a line drooping, sagging, something along those lines, that's what sparks a fire.
Mm-hmm.
And provided they're following those guidelines or those rules, really, it really minimizes those chances. Mm-hmm. Doesn't eliminate them, but it minimizes them.
I think it was very telling, the one sentence, with most going above and beyond the normal requirements and procedures in terms of being cognizant of the conditions, particularly this past year with the widespread drought throughout North Dakota.
And to kind of clarify that one, you know, most of the responses detailed additional efforts. That doesn't mean the ones that did not say it aren't doing it.
Right.
They just didn't specifically mention it in the responses. I mean, some of the responses were a single page, and some of them were numerous pages. So kind of the wide variety of detail provided.
Okay. So I'm assuming, Victor, that your memo and any of the filings you'd be willing to provide to Adam if he's interested.
Certainly.
Okay. Do you have any other questions?
No, but I'll just say that, you know, after spring, we sure did see a lot less of those kinds of fires. And probably some of it could be attributed to the fact that by the time we probably got past the middle or into June, the grass was pretty well grazed down to nothing, and the crops didn't materialize to anything. And so if a little something did start, it was easy to put out, and we probably never heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of it also had to do with people becoming very cautious and doing the right thing. So
yeah.
I think it was a good follow-up and a pretty good result.
Yeah.
And provides a basis to follow next spring if we see similar conditions, which we may.
Certainly.
Okay, we should talk to MDU when they're here in the PI meeting, just briefly about this. I don't know what else is on that agenda, but it's a good one to just get a follow-up. What kinds of issues they had, if any, during the summer, and you know, if they did double down on some of their efforts, and what they're anticipating moving into potentially another dry spring year.
During the periodic information
yes.
exchange.
Conveniently planned right before Thanksgiving. All right. Very good. Thank you, Victor. Appreciate your follow-up on that. Number two, Internet Protocol Service Provider Registration Requirements. Patrick.
I'll start out on this one. I have the team with, though, so we got Victor. And I thought, I was expecting Brian, but Jack will probably handle that part of it. Currently on our website, we have instructions for two companies when they need to register with using our online registration program. And we recently, Victor's recently had a challenge, and I had one challenge before that from VoIP providers, voice over internet protocol providers, whether they needed to register on our website. And so we looked into, took another look at the law regarding voice over internet providers. And we've all concluded, and consensus is that these telecommunications companies do not need to register with the commission. And so the thought was that we would put a statement on our website, since we've been getting several calls, we put instructions on our website that they do not need to register.
So, Pat, most likely I have been misunderstanding something, or you misstated something, one of the two.
Okay.
You said these telecommunications companies. And I've been understanding that that is the crux of the situation, that a court case and possibly a law from a few years ago, a state law, clarified that someone who is a voice over internet protocol provider is not a telecommunications company, and thus that's what causes it to fall out of the realm of people who have to register with us. Is that correct? That's where the crux is, that they're not considered telecommunications companies.
The court case says, I know Brian was looking at a court case that says that they are not. The FCC hasn't made a final determination on it, and our state law does not say that. Our state law still calls them telecommunications carriers or companies, but so there's a lot of things that are up in the air.
I guess I'll just throw in my two cents as the portfolio holder. I'm feeling that until the FCC decides to take an action, what the courts have said is what we need to go by, and that's that they're not telecommunications companies, and so they don't need to register with us. Even though this is one of those, like a previous case we had on our agenda today, where I wish it were different. I liked having them register with it. I don't know why they object so strenuously. But the fact of the matter is, if we end up with a North Dakota citizen that has a complaint or something, it's so much simpler for us to serve those people and follow up and find out what the issue is if these companies are registered and we know who to talk to or where to find them. But we can't defy federal law, in my opinion, so I just don't think we can force them to register.
Can I ask what triggered this? Like, why are we talking about this? Is somebody requesting not to register, or is somebody requesting
us? Provider refuses.
Okay.
Yeah. We have a company who wants to provide service in Devil's Lake and wants a number ported to them by North Dakota Telephone Company. North Dakota Telephone Company initially refused to do the port. I spoke to them, and one of their concerns was this company wasn't registered, which I found to be the case, so I reached out to this company. Oddly enough, they're very bad at communications, In any case, they proceeded to argue, hire a consultant, and kind of led us down this road of getting involving Brian Impact and determining. They kind of both threw back at us our state law and this federal court case or district court case.
Okay. And the FCC is looking at it, not looking at it, just...
It's been an issue at the FCC for some time. And initially they said internet content providers, they said those people were not telecommunication companies for sure. But they never ever said whether a voice over internet protocol service was a telecommunications service or not. They still haven't decided that. In the court case that Brian was looking at, even says that the FCC hasn't made a determination on it.
Basically, because they haven't made a determination on it, the court kind of stepped in and said that it's not telecommunications as they see it, and it's more transfer of information.
Do we have a lot of these companies operating and people using them?
Becoming more and more. We have at least those that have voice over IP in their name in one way, shape, or form or another. I think we had at least four that were registered. Beyond that, it's hard to tell if they are, how they operate.
Yeah.
Or how many customers.
Yep.
We don't know.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Actually, this one, once I got into a little bit further, they have been operating in North Dakota for some period of time already.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A legal question that I didn't think of before when we discussed this. If North Dakota passed a law that said VoIP providers need to register, would that be in conflict with that circuit court opinion? Or is a circuit opinion just that as long as no one has clarified it, they don't have to?
I think if North Dakota had a law stating that, it would be in conflict with the federal decision.
Would be in conflict?
Stating that they would be, the way you said it, yes, I believe it would be in conflict if we stated that they were under regulation.
But and maybe that's the point of clarification. I mean, we're not trying to regulate them in what we're thinking of as a traditional sense. We really just want contact information so that, for the exact reason you said, if we have a customer complaint, it's easier to work through versus trying to hunt down from a generic number on a website someone to help.
So just register. Don't right. they have to register if, as a if, business at least? Aren't they registered with the Secretary of State?
I don't believe this company is. And some of them have arguments on for that. It kind of depends on their billing structure. You know, if they're not directly billing a customer, an argument can be made they're not operating in North Dakota.
Okay. Are other states struggling with this too? We talked, is South Dakota, is this an issue?
I did not reach out on that, I don't know.
Yeah.
The case does come out of Minnesota. And the 8th Circuit is the circuit that North Dakota falls under as well, so it's very closely linked to North Dakota in that regard.
The case came from, Minnesota was trying to make it a voice over IP, and they fought back.
Okay.
But regardless, or correct me if I'm wrong, our statutory structure also prevents us from doing this as well. We're not just relying solely on the 8th Circuit case, because of our statutory structure, as Commissioner stated, did provide that we would require this, we would carry this forward regardless of the 8th Circuit case until overruled, even if we believe we were in conflict.
That is correct.
What now? No, that's confusing.
So we have, there was a statute passed, in, I think it was 2015, I was here already at this point in time, essentially exempting VoIP service from regulation as well.
Okay,
so
I remember that right now. AT&T pushed it, didn't they?
I believe it was AT&T.
Yeah.
So So our law does fall in line with the Eighth Circuit Court decision. So.
Okay. So then it's super clear. I mean, we have to follow our law. All right. Okay. Anything else on that?
No.
Okay. Then we get to go to the funnest part of the whole meetings.
Madam Chair.
JP Hager Enterprises.
Moved down from regular agenda. PU 21338.
Yes. Oh, to discussion, that's right. I'm sorry.
Right. I think this will be fairly quick. Here's where I'm at. It was the quick version of it and the accurate version. Had an operator, excavator, did not get a ticket. We're performing work in Harvey, doing some concrete work, did not get a ticket. Work with advocacy staff. The consent agreement would be for $1,500 for excavating without a ticket. But the thing that caught my eye when I was reading the order, $500 would be remittable with $1,000 suspended. So my concern is from an element of fairness and consistency. I don't recall suspending any more than half of the penalty, at least not during my time, unless there was a unique case I'm just not thinking of. But they didn't have a ticket, and I would be far more comfortable where my position is to suspend half, like we normally do. And again, just being consistent and fair, with the assumption that the $1,500 penalty is deemed appropriate, and then to suspend $750 and have $750 remittable. So that's why I held it over, just because of the suspended portion not being consistent with what we've done in the past.
So why did staff, why did you do the hires?
I don't think he can tell us. Victor worked with them.
So it's a consent agreement? Yes. So we'd basically be rejecting that consent agreement.
Right. So then procedurally, this is a question I had with Jack. Do we vote to deny this, or can it be modified and then vote on a different amount, but then the party isn't expecting that either? So
a number of things could happen. You could direct staff to go and try to renegotiate the new settlement agreement based upon the direction. You could also deny it, and that would be forced to continue moving forward regardless, or staff could again renegotiate it in the meantime, or you could modify it, which is the little more of a messy procedure to go through, which it requires then allows not we have to provide an opportunity then for the party then to subsequently withdraw agreement to the settlement agreement in a period of time,
It seems like the cleanest would be for staff to go back and renegotiate, see if the excavator is in agreement, and granted they're probably not going to be excited about it because it's another $250 that they have to pay versus what they were expecting, and then suspending the other half. But I think the one point is making sure we're comfortable with the $1,500 amount. Otherwise we get into, okay, now they're in agreement with that, but we get into part two, and hopefully that's not the case. Right.
So if we were to deny the settlement, they need to know that they can come up with another one, or it goes to hearing, correct?
That's correct.
We couldn't, and then after that we could order anything.
Yes.
Yep. Right? It could be higher. If after they go to hearing, they might end up paying more. So I guess those are the options.
Does staff confirm, because I don't recall, are we correct that we've never suspended over half of a penalty?
I think maybe more unique cases than this case is, we have suspended more than half. One easy example, but it's different. Landowner or homeowner cases, we generally, as long as there's nothing damaged, if it's just a failure to get a ticket before digging, we suspend the entire $500 penalty.
There have also been other instances outside of damage prevention. Again, they're rarities more than anything, like the Granville pipeline safety case, if you recall.
Well, in a previous case, one of the points was that there was a consent agreement signed, and here we have one signed too. I guess I'd be comfortable with this as it is.
Does that compromise our ability in the future from a consistency standpoint, or even in previous cases, which have been decided, for someone to say, well, we were digging without a ticket. We were fined $500, $1,000, $1,500, and only half of ours was suspended. So why is this different? And I think it's very cut and dried, they were digging without a ticket. I think this is, it's not unique in comparison to some of the other cases, at least on the surface. And again, we can't get the inside information with advocacy. Mm-hmm. So my thought is that there's just, I don't see anything unique. They were digging without a ticket, and that's a violation. So
Well, I mean, we aren't voting on anything right now.
No.
So I guess you can take what you've heard and decide whether you want to bring it back.
Or schedule a work session, too.
I don't know what a work session would do.
I think proceed.
Because we can't really talk through the details of the settlement anyways.
I think it'd be more from a procedural standpoint, how we... Well, I can I don't know if we...
I mean, we have two choices. One, you can bring forward the original motion and have everybody vote on it. Or I think bring it forward and it either passes or it fails. If it fails, then staff goes back and renegotiates. If it passes, then it's done.
Right.
I think that's really the next step.
Sure, and if in the event that this is something the commission would like to establish moving forward, some additional direction about how to, negotiate penalties, you could have a work session to discuss the general issue.
Okay. All right. I think it's good to be consistent, and I'm fine with pushing back on the consent agreement personally. But
ideally, I'm thinking, okay, if I'm the excavator, I would really prefer to not have this motion go to a vote with the chance. I don't know how the vote would go, but there's certainly a chance it would be denied. And then it continues to drag out, if you will, continues to be processed. It's additional exposure that I don't, while I realize they're not going to be excited about an additional $250 out of their pocket, I also don't think they'd be excited about having it go to a vote and then it just perpetuates for a longer period of time. So just a thought that, and I think I expressed that when I was talking with Jack, that just out of that consideration from an operator standpoint.
So you're asking for it to be delayed, right?
I would like, my preference is to go back to the operator and excavator and get the number changed and see if they're in agreement to that, to withdraw the consent agreement, file a new one, get a new order drafted. Otherwise, we're going to have to go through the other steps. And it might work out the way it's written, and it might not. But I really think consistency is important.
Well,
and it'd be less.
Right now, we've held it, right?
Yeah, right. So it has to be on the next one.
I mean, we could vote on it right now.
Good.
And then you have a direction.
Do we have to vote on it either way?
It's Commissioner Crosius's portfolio.
You're not in the mic.
It's Commissioner Crosius's portfolio. He could withdraw it. And then bring forth a motion he's more comfortable with later.
Okay.
I'll withdraw it.
All right. Very good. Then moving on to scheduling.
Well, I looked through those dates and some things I wish were different, but then looking at them closely, I understand the reasoning for them. I think it's a well thought out plan, and I think we should just approve it.
What did you think you wanted different?
Well, at first I seen how many times there were 3-week gaps, and I was trying to find a good solution to lessen the amount of those. And in researching it, I found reasons why they were done, and you know, the solutions ended up causing a 3-week gap necessity somewhere else, and in some cases more than one. So I couldn't come up with a better resolution on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent quite a bit of time on it.
Yeah, there's lots of meetings to plan around.
That's an understatement.
Okay.
Here's a quick question on January 5th, 2022. Does that overlap our impact mark, or run into Mark?
No, Mark starts Thursday.
Thursday yeah.
Evening.
Oh, okay.
The only thing I don't see on here is the NARUC Executive Committee meetings. I'm pretty sure they're not on Wednesdays, but that schedule has been very hard for me to get my hands on, and it seems like it should just be added to my calendar. Right? Like it should have been just, I should have been added to the invite list. So I'm pretty sure they don't meet on Wednesdays, but if they do monthly, then we'd be forced to have not regularly scheduled meetings, which is a pain because then you can't take up new anything off the agenda. So,
so
we don't have an
informal
decision
until you find that out.
If we can, I mean, I realize it's good to get these dates blocked off, but and we aren't reconvening today at all.
And I think last year we didn't finalize it until December. This was just really supposed to be a starting point. I didn't expect it to be set in stone.
Okay, let me double check that then, and we can.
We just wanted to make sure things didn't fill up and make it more complicated.
No, I agree, and it is good to start saving these dates. So, okay, let me just double check that, and then we can finalize it the next time. Okay, Victor, next up, or should we do the surface coal mining first before we do the quarterly RTO meeting, since that's probably more time sensitive, or not, I don't know, is it rulemaking? Okay, what are your thoughts, Jack?
So this is regarding the real property collateral bond rulemaking. And if we send it out today, which you guys approved the notice of hearing, the earliest we possibly could have it is December 21st to be within the requirements of the 2832. However, the Newspaper Association is recommending that we allow another 7 days in addition to the 20 days due to the fact that, as we've experienced, and I'm sure they've experienced as well, frequently a newspaper will miss publishing it. So that happens enough. It might be an issue. So it allows an extra 7 days then to allow them to make sure the publication happens. So that would put us around December 27th.
I find that very disturbing that there's that much inconsistency in how they publish stuff. But, I mean, it's their bread and butter. I mean, yeesh.
Where are we at with timing as far as, so like, we do it and then, you know, let's say that there's not much objection or controversy around it, maybe approve something at a following meeting, and then, you know, it gets into that whole circle of those quarterly meetings.
Sure. So this is we'll depart from our normal rulemaking process because this has to be approved by the Office of Surface and Mining, if you recall. Mm. And so the normal process for these would be that we, of course, draft them, approve them for adoption, send it to the AG for approval, get Office of Surface and Mining approval, and then after that, it goes to Legislative Council. So we're really dependent upon how quickly the OSM can get it back to us, which we have experienced hasn't been too fast. From that standpoint, and I guess while we're discussing it, then I have requested an extension for the rulemaking based upon that fact from the Legislative Council as well, which will be on the next Administrative Rules Committee.
What was the deadline for this? What did they tell us we needed?
It's 9 months from enactment, so it would have been January 1st.
Okay. Was there an emergency clause on this?
No, that's standard for...
Oh, rules.
For all.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's,
you had mentioned something about newspapers not getting it, or missing it, not getting it in.
Failing to publish it.
Here's my thought on that. It is their bread and butter. It's a very good revenue stream for them. And if there are entities out there that compromise that, they know that this occasionally, not even occasionally, it has come up before the legislature in terms of public notices and a requirement to publish them in the official county paper. And if they have some bad actors, if that compromises all of their ability, that's up to the newspaper group, the newspaper association, to drive that process and make darn sure it's in on time without fail, or they risk. There's not going to be less pressure over the course of time as print numbers continue to drop. There's going to be more pressure. I'd be sounding the alarm bell at NDNA saying, don't miss these because we don't need to give, you know, a reason to have that change because it's a little. Without it, there are actually some county newspapers, frankly, that probably wouldn't remain profitable. I mean, they get up to that point of break even, and then that creates their margin. Without it, it's tough sledding. So,
but that's their problem.
Correct.
But our problem is that we need to get this done. It's a long drawn out process. I forgot about the OSM part of it, and so to scrimp over a week and then potentially because someone out of our control fails and then cost ourselves 6 or 8 weeks to reschedule it because we can't have it, that's no good either. If we give them the extra week, we're into that week between Christmas and New Year's. A lot of people are off and it's difficult for them to participate. What if we have it on the 4th, the day before what is at least tentatively planned for our first regular scheduled meeting of 2022, so I assume nobody's like in a long trip or something.
Yep.
Possibly, yeah.
That works for me.
Maybe the afternoon of the 4th.
Okay.
One last quick thing. I'll visit with you after the meeting. If you give me just an example or two of when that's occurred, I'll make a call to NDNA and stress the importance, and they get it. I can have that conversation with them.
Sure. Well, it's happened at our sighting as well as.
Right.
Right. Okay, so we got that January 4th at 10?
No, let's go in the afternoon.
Okay. January 4th at 1:30?
Sure. In case somebody's traveling back.
Sure.
So January 4th.
Tuesday. All right. 1:30. And then quarterly meetings, RTO meetings. All right, so.
Semi-annual.
Now, I have something to ask. Should we be doing more? Should we be doing three? And here's why. I'm just wondering. That's my favorite vision. Jack walking, or Brian walking by with the baby. It's our time to have one-on-one conversations with them, and there's a lot going on, and there's a lot more going to be going on, and it's an opportunity for the people who aren't dealing directly with, be given RTO to hear from and about what's going on there. So I don't know, I just throw that out. Should we be doing three?
Sure. I think we used to actually do quarterly years back, and then
I
forget how long ago we went down
to
a couple times a year.
Yeah.
We decided to do two quarterly meetings a year.
Yeah. So, not to belabor this conversation any longer, but it's three or two. I think we've had a hard time keeping two, so I think four might be an optimistic, like an overly ambitious goal, but three. And then I think we need to change the format so that the utilities are at the table with the RTOs and available to talk.
We can absolutely invite them.
Yeah, because they sit there and there's nobody saying, no, that's not how it works. You know, there's that give and take is missing. And I think it's better for us to hear both sides and we can decide which one we believe.
Which utilities?
The regulated utilities. Well, for MISO anyway, and maybe Basin. Just Basin comes.
But SPP has other members besides Basin in North Dakota.
Well, whoever you think. Any of them. I mean, I think it would be great to hear from their members.
Some pretty long meetings.
Well, not everybody has to give a report. They don't all have to, they're just part of the dialogue. So the RTOs, we'd set the agenda. We'd set the agenda for each meeting however we want it. Maybe sometimes we ask the utilities to report, sometimes we don't. But they are still able to respond to and ask questions of, and we can ask questions of them, like MISO says, you know, we're proposing X because we think it does this. We could say, well, do you agree to the utilities? And they can then, you know, speak their mind.
Since we haven't done one of these even for so long, the travel issues and all that, why don't we just schedule one and we can invite the members,
okay,
and see how that goes, and move on from there, and decide whether how many we want to do per year. Why don't we just schedule one?
That sounds good. But I'm going to ask staff, which is you, Victor, to be pushy about getting the next one scheduled after that. Okay,
sure.
Just make sure that it's on the next agenda.
Well, maybe just from a timing perspective, as soon as the next one happens, we schedule the next one.
Right, at the next meeting.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
All right. So have you talked to any of them?
I haven't. I was kind of trying to figure out how to even do that. I wasn't sure how far out we need to go for your schedules. So I was hoping to get a small handful of dates, maybe two or three, and then I'll give, have Adam work with MISO like usual, and I'll work with the SPP folks, and now on the additional company representatives.
So let's jump into January.
Are we expecting the RTOs to be here, or are we planning these to be virtual meetings?
Could be either. I mean, I would have guessed that they'll send a couple people. Maybe they have some technical folks that they keep on.
Because, I mean, if that's the case, we can't schedule something for 2-3 weeks out.
I think we should look at flight arrangement. I mean, that's just, there's enough going on between now and the end of the year. Let's just jump into January.
The SPP guys love January, February, North Dakota. So.
Yeah. Well, toughen up, SPP. Keep the power on. Exactly. Come up here on the day when you don't want to do rolling blackouts.
75 degree day in May, that's...
I think it's good for all of them to experience it. MISO too. I'm looking at the January 10th, 11th, 12th time period on the schedule that they sent us.
It's all good for me. Is there a question to us? Or is it just for Victor to reach out?
We're supposed to give him a few dates. How does the... The 10th look. That's right after. Or the 12th. We don't have a proposed commission meeting date. Does the 12th seem reasonable? 10th or 12th?
10th or 12th.
I suppose Martin Luther King Day isn't a good one.
Well, that following week is the week before our quarterly meeting, which will be the first live meeting of
in
2 years.
That's kind of...
And so I just think SPP staff is going to have their hands full.
Sure. That the week of the 17th, and then that week would be out too, so maybe we just try for one of those.
We'll try for those for right now, and if we, Adam and I can come back to the three of you individually if we have some conflicts with that.
The 11th would work on my schedule too.
Yeah, do they... have the 10th is, that means Sunday travel for some of them, right?
I would, it could be. I would think as long as we have a remote option for some of those folks, more so, I'm less worried about it. Like, SPP guys are used to doing those kind of things, so I don't think they would care when we do it.
All right.
But some of our utilities in the state, you know, so someone from Williston may not be excited about traveling here Sunday night or very early Monday morning. So,
well, let's see what we can do for dates and then finalize. And
kind of along with us, so since we're inviting the North Dakota co-ops that are members of SVP, should we invite Minkota as well?
I'll leave you guys up to who should be invited. I don't know.
Well, no, Minkota's a MISO member, right?
Oh, from MISO. Sure.
Does Cass Electric have their own membership?
I'm not sure. Maybe.
We'll find out.
Yeah, I don't ever see those
know
guys.
The
I never
SPP.
See Cass Electric
I,
there.
I don't know for certain on MISO, but Adam will figure it out.
Yeah. Okay, sounds good.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I think that's everything. So, we're adjourned. Thanks, everyone.